You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
Hey, I'm Captain Dean, and on this episode, I am sitting with a very talented singer-songwriter who's been in bands Sixth Floor, Southbound, and I'm trying to think of the others because I'm winging this. I didn't write it down.
The first one was Gypsy Outlaw.
Gypsy Outlaw, and then was that with Chris Perkins?
Yep.
And that's what I thought. And you were in Kansas at the time. Was it Kansas City?
No, that was the first band I was in Glasgow, and then after that band didn't work out, I ended up moving to Kansas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, my guest is John King. Welcome to the Sound Atlas.
Thanks for having me.
I did not write down an intro.
Well.
Normally I do, but I didn't feel like it. I didn't do it for anybody today. Well, John, thank you for doing this, and we are at Mellow Matt's Music and More,
the premier music
store in Bowling Green. It still feels like Record Bar a little bit, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
He's captured the Record Bar essence. Well, John, I start all these with the wonderful question of where are you from?
I'm from Berksville, Kentucky. I was born in Berksville, lived there until I was in about, fifth grade, and then my mom got a job in Glasgow.
Okay.
And we ended up moving to Glasgow, and I lived in Glasgow until I graduated high school.
What's the difference between Berksville and Glasgow? About an hour?
30 miles. Nah,
that's not even that far.
Yeah.
Okay, so I knew you grew up in Glasgow. I knew that you had strong roots there. But I think a lot of people, when they refer to you, in Morgantown, which I know you've lived for a while.
Yeah, I moved to Morgantown in 2003, which, you know, most of the band, well, George and Jared are both from that area.
Okay, so that made sense.
And we practiced there. Even when I lived in Bowling Green, we first started in 95.
Yeah.
I drove there 3 days a week to practice, so they just made considered sense us to move. Morgantown. Yeah.
Well, going back to that, you born in Berksville, raised in Glasgow. When did you get started in music?
Well, like when I was young, we had piano around my grandma's house. I always played around on that. Beat on stuff, it's not kids do.
Right. But
I got a guitar. My mom got me an electric guitar when I was about 15.
Okay.
And that's when I lived in Glasgow. I went and took one guitar lesson at it was Backstage Music when it
right.
was at the old place. And I wanted to learn how to play Heaven's on Fire. And the guy wanted me to learn how to play scales. And that was the last guitar
I would see that as a immediate headbutting.
Yeah. I wanted to skip all that stuff and just go straight to playing
scales and Heaven's on Fire. Yes, two different worlds.
But the King side of the family, my grandpa, when he was young, he had his own radio show in Berksville and was really getting popular, you know, and played for years till he started having kids and kind of slowed down. And my uncle Jimmy is a real good guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
My dad plays guitar, but every time I've seen him pick it up, he plays Sunshine of Your Love, and that's all I've ever seen him play. So I don't know how much he actually
But
knows.
At least, I mean, you obviously come from a long line of musical talent. At least everybody knew how to play guitar.
Yep.
But none of them really pursued it like you did?
Well, they were in bands. When they were younger, they were in bands, but they didn't
Set out to go on tour or anything like that. Well, I remember the record we made, which we'll touch on at some point. You put a track at the end of it
mm-hmm.
of your grandparents, right?
Yep.
It was your grandfather and your grandmother
mm-hmm.
performing a song together.
Yeah. My grandma, she just passed away last year, but mm-hmm. I didn't know that she'd sang until about 10 years ago.
Isn't that crazy?
My grandpa, he's always pulling out old videos and stuff like that. And he gave me that tape, told me to check it out. And they were like singing, sound like, you know, something you'd hear from the 50s, but they were in perfect harmony. And I didn't even know if she ever sang. She never told me she sang or anything.
Wow.
And but yeah,
all those years of you being a musician, I wonder why she
never, I don't know.
Never brought it up.
She just fussed about my long hair. That's all she talked about.
Yeah, that's about right. I've heard that. Okay, so who was the teacher at Backstage Music? Is his name Kenny?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't Kenny Weber.
Weber was one of them, though, because I've heard in of some of these podcasts I've hosted, people have mentioned his name.
Yeah.
So it wasn't him.
No, he owned the store, I think, at the time. But
okay.
The guy that gave me I don't remember what his name was. I know he had a mullet, and I went back later on.
Call him Mullet Man.
Later on, they told me he joined a Elvis impersonator and was touring with him.
Very interesting.
I don't really know who he was.
But obviously you had the one lesson, right? And that was it.
Yeah.
Didn't really get anything out of it, huh?
I didn't even attempt to really play until I was probably 19 or 20.
Okay, so a few years went by before you even, like, pursued it.
Yeah, and I used to always carry around, like, around senior year in high school, and after that, I always carry around a notebook and always write lyrics.
Okay.
But I never really tried to play much. And then when I moved to Kansas, I started, you know, I was like, well, I got all these lyrics and I need to figure out how to play guitar, you know.
Right.
So that's
Before we jump too far ahead, when you got good at guitar, was it on your own, or did your grandfather or your dad show you anything, or
I just learned by ear. And my grandpa played a right-handed guitar, left-handed, upside down, and acoustic.
Wow.
Kind of like Hendrix, but he played gospel music on an acoustic.
Yeah.
And I never could learn from him.
Didn't Dick Dale do that? I don't know. There's a lot of people that play upside down. I've never understood how that could even be done.
He'll hit a G chord and hit it with his thumb up over the neck, and it's
kind of
crazy.
Odd to look at.
My grandpa runs a TV shop, and he's accident-prone. And I came in one time, and he pulled his chord finger, and he's like cut the hole from that part down like an inch of his finger off of his main chord finger.
Oh, wow.
And I said, well, I don't guess you can play guitar anymore. And he pulled out a little plastic thing he made in his shop and stuck it on his finger.
That's the old Tony Iommi trick.
Yep.
That's wild. Okay, so you get going on guitar on your own terms. The band you first formed or joined, or like, how did you get into, like, I guess working with other musicians? Like, what was the first initial thing?
Gypsy Outlaw was the first band I was in. Okay. It was me and Kevin Gross and Brian Goodwin and Chris Perkins and Lee Hammer on bass.
And what year was that?
That was probably
like early 90s, right?
90 or 90. Yeah, it was 90, I think.
Okay.
Because we played our first show, only show we played, was it in Louisville. Or in Lexington at Central Park West.
So were you ever in any, like, garage bands that never amounted to anything? Or did you just actually start that group or join that group, and that was your first introduction?
That was pretty much a garage band. And the thing I had going in Kansas, you know, we played a few shows and recorded a demo.
Right.
But I consider being a garage band, too.
But at least, I mean, you were doing something.
Yeah,
you were active. You were... Obviously, you played gigs at the band out there.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a different band?
Yeah. After Gypsy Outlaw didn't work out, I ended up moving to Kansas. A buddy of mine had been to Kansas and worked out there, and I was just looking to get out of Glasgow. It was that kind of after school, didn't know what I was going to do.
Right.
Me and my mom butting heads all the time, and I was just kind of like, I need to go somewhere else. So we got on a Greyhound bus, and I think he knew a girl that lived there. We had probably $40 between us and got on the Greyhound bus. And the bus ride, I guess
usually it's usually stories like that end with going to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But you made it to Kansas.
But we were on the bus for 21 hours. Yeah. I guess it was because we got the cheap ticket
stops
everywhere.
Yeah.
Went to Tennessee before we went to Kansas.
Yep.
But got there, and he knew this family, and they let us stay with him and stuff. And I ended up staying for 3 years. I stayed a year longer than he did. I ended up meeting people and playing music. And
so you were playing the whole time you were out there?
Yeah, I hooked up with a band, and I lived in Bonner Springs, which is right outside of Kansas City, and I met these dudes through an ad or something, and they were in Lawrence, Kansas, where KU's at.
Yeah.
And I think it was the first gig we ever played was at the Bottleneck, which when we went in there, it's like the Chili Peppers played there, and it was a pretty big bar, but
yeah.
I just recently, the guitar player in that band, we connected on Facebook, and he just sent me about 2 weeks ago the audio from that show. And it's crazy.
That must be a blast from the past.
Yeah, sound like I'm 12.
So that was obviously your introduction into this world that you have been in ever since.
Mm-hmm.
You do end up coming back to Glasgow, I'm assuming.
No, I came back to Lexington.
You came back to Lexington.
Yeah, because I was getting out of Kansas, and Chris Perkins which me and him were friends when he was in school. I used to go over to his house, and he just, you know him, he was an awesome talent.
I got to know him later in life. I just recently interviewed Joshua Riddle, who was in the band Section 8 with him.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, good. I'm glad we're bringing up his name, because there's so many people now that are gone that aren't here to tell their stories.
Yep.
So, again, I'm glad that you're here to talk about Chris Perkins.
He was a talented fellow.
Oh, my God.
Like I said,
it's amazing.
He, back then, I don't know if he was still in school. I think he was a senior.
Hmm.
And I'd go over and hang out with him. And he was actually living with his teacher, one of his teachers. But I remember going over there and watching the Moscow Music Peace Festival.
Oh, yeah. With him. That was a big deal.
But he had a Ibanez Proline Series Flying V. And you go over there and you could say, play Randy Rhodes, this, yeah. Jakey Lee, whatever.
He was one of those.
He knew all of it.
He was one of those. It didn't take him long. He learned it all by ear, and just amazing talent.
But when I lived in Kansas, the guys I was in a band with up there, we were all just kind of looking to go somewhere else and try something else. And Lexington at the time was a pretty big scene.
Yeah.
And it was either Austin, Texas, or Lexington, and I decided to go to Lexington because it was closer to home.
Close to home. But like you said, at that point in the early mid-90s, you had Superfuzz.
Well, it was actually that about that time was Black Cat Bone. That
That's right. Before Black Superfuzz. Cat Bone was prior to that.
But I can't remember all the bands, but it was a pretty good scene.
It was pretty good, yeah. Because a lot of them came down here. I used to remember catching their names on flyers and stuff, but
I remember talking to a girl at a bar, and she was talking to me, and she was like, yeah, I was hung out with this dude the other night, and he was in a band, and she said his name was Chris. She said he could really sing. And I said, what's the name of the band? And she said, Soundscape or Sound something. I said, Soundgarden. And she said, yeah, that was it. And I could tell she wasn't lying because she didn't know. But I was like, you were hanging out with Chris Cornell? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, man.
That would have been like, what album? That was before Bad Motorfinger, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's right about that time.
Yeah. Wow. Well, yeah, because they all toured through here. None of us knew who they were. That's funny. That's a cool story. But you end up in Lexington, and this would have been in the early, mid-90s.
It was, yeah. It was 93 or 94, I think. Right.
Because Sixth Floor was born in 95.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that very well. But how did you get from, I mean, what did you do in Lexington prior to coming back down here and Sixth Floor getting formed?
Me and the dudes that I was in a band with up there came down here to jam with Chris and got down there, and we pretty much lived in a storage unit. It was like a big storage place, and they had these big rehearsal spaces that they rented, and it was a pretty good sized room, but no running water or anything.
Right.
And we rented this place and pretty much lived there. There was like five of us living there, and it was like the other bands.
That smelled great.
Oh, man. The other bands would come in. And there was a band that played like on one side of us, and they were like older dudes and looked like Van Halen or something. Their singer was like a real pretty looking dude, and they were playing Zeppelin and stuff like that. But we go over there and hang out, and they were always like, man, y'all got to make it. You know, the hell you're putting yourself through now, you know, it's got to pay off someday.
But yep.
It kind of wore thin on us after a while, and a couple of the guys decided to go back home, and that's how I ended up back in Bowling Green.
Okay. So you came to Bowling Green, right?
Yeah.
You didn't necessarily live in Glasgow? Or
mm-mm.
Okay. Because I've heard, I mean, obviously up to this point, just about everyone I've interviewed has mentioned your name or the Sixth Floor band name. And they all have stories to tell. And of course, Sprouse mentioned something about he used to come and hang out with you guys around the time you formed. He didn't even think you had the name yet. But Nick Green was there, and there was a dog with green hair. I could literally go back to every podcast I've done so far and pull out a tidbit of something to do with you or Sixth Floor.
If you go past where Thursdays was, like you were going toward campus where the road used to fork.
Yes.
There used to be a yellow house right in the middle of
the
fork.
Subway, right? There was a big brick building and Kinko's, and there was a subway in it. But yes, there was a row of houses before that parking lot now.
Yeah.
And it was right there.
That's where me and Nick were roommates, and that's where we lived at.
Okay.
And that's sixth floor used to practice there, like with the windows open and it's loud. The first time we ever practiced was actually at Kentucky Music. But
yeah, I remember they had a rehearsal space, mm-hmm. and then they built a recording studio like above it. That was definitely early 90s.
Yeah.
How did you meet George and Jared? And I know you've had a lot of bass players, and we can touch on that if you want to. But when the band initially got started, how did it get started?
It was a... I don't know if... I can't remember if they had an ad up or I put an ad up. But Jared... I think I had an ad up. But Jared called me one day, and it was like November of 94.
Right.
And he was like, man, we're looking to for a new singer, and saw your ad and stuff, and saw you do original stuff. And we kind of talked back and forth, and something was going on, but we couldn't really... It was a month or two before we actually got together. Mm-hmm. But I remember talking to Jared, and he was like, what are you into, man? And I was like, I'm into Pantera and stuff like that. And I was like, what are you into? And he said, Candlebox and stuff like that. And he said other stuff. He was into
too
some
bad
cool,
he didn't say the Carpenters.
He was into some cool stuff, but he liked most of the stuff I like. I just like to aggravate him about that.
Right. But it was like, you're into heavy stuff. He's into the new, at the time, mm-hmm. era stuff, you know? But you all ended up getting together and obviously testing the waters.
Yeah.
So what was the formation of this band? Because I remember Seth Sprouse said he was around you guys when you were jamming, mm-hmm. but you didn't have the name yet. So yeah. Do you recall much of the early days or how many times you all actually jammed and worked together before it was actually starting to become something?
Yeah, we got together. They were a band at the time. They were already in a band, and they had a singer, and they were called Cycling Sam. And I was like, I'll jam with you dudes, but that ain't going to work.
That name's got to go.
I said, I don't like come in and start demanding stuff. I said, but that name's just not going to
work. Well, a name like that, everybody would be like, which one's Sam?
Yeah. But we decided to meet up at Kentucky Music and jam, and their singer that they had at the time that they supposedly got rid of, I guess nobody thought
didn't
to tell him.
Yeah.
And so he
Everybody
shows up.
The balls to tell him.
He shows up at the practice, and I went to high school with him.
Oh, great.
And he's That's like, great. Hey, man, what are you doing here? And I was like, supposed to be singing. I said, what are you doing here? He said, I'm the singer. And I was like, that's kind of weird. And we ended up jamming, and both of us like singing stuff. And,
wow.
Like, I really clicked with him, and I could tell, and they were already wanting to get rid of him. And
but you played guitar too, right?
Yeah.
You were never like just a lead singer.
When we first started, I played guitar, but I didn't play much. Like a lot of our first album, I didn't even play on.
So you did have moments where you just had a microphone. Mm-hmm. Okay. I thought so, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, and I never was comfortable without a guitar.
Right.
I'm not, right. I don't move it's around. Weird. I just stand there and hang on the mic stand. But we actually had a lawyer when we were. Thought we were about to get signed in New York, and he told me he saw videos, and he was like, you need to play guitar, because I guess he could tell I wasn't comfortable.
Awkward stance.
Yeah. I don't know what to do with my hands.
That's great. So when that got rolling, I mean, like you said, late 94 is when you all kind of started talking, but by early 1995, I mean, you all were rolling by summer. I can say that for a fact because I saw you in August of 1994, mm-hmm. or 95. So by summer of 1995, the band was established. And who was in the band? Which it's clear everyone knows that George and Jared mm-hmm. were in Sixth Floor, and they still are, even though there was a gap of time off or whatever. Yeah. But who was the original bass player?
Dave Shaver.
Okay.
And he was in the band for the first two albums. I think he was in there about 5 years.
Okay.
And we kind of went different directions, which he ended up playing in El Masivo.
Okay, that's right.
Mm. And he lives in Florida now. I still talk to him every once in a while. We're still friends, but
that's good.
He moved down to Florida. But
he didn't want to come up for the reunion? So Dave is in the band originally, and mm-hmm. then you ended up going through like a Spinal Tap of bass players, mm-hmm. so to speak. And we can hit on that if you want to. But when the band got rolling, like I said, I saw you in the summer of 95. And I saw you because we played a Battle of the Bands together.
Yeah, and you beat us.
And we beat you. And what was your wonderful way of putting that?
I was just like, well, I didn't help us out by there was a bunch of old people up front, and I'm hammered and cussing every three words.
But my favorite thing was years later, you tell me, we just got beat by a band called Tomatoes.
Yeah.
But when you guys came out, it was pretty clear to me that you had some friends there. I mean, you had some people come up to the stage mm-hmm. when you all were performing. And it was intense. Like, you came out swinging, I think, as a band.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty obvious that at this point in the year 2019, to look back all the way to 1995, how dominating Sixth Floor was, at least for a decade.
Yeah.
You did spawn off and do other things, but from the beginning of that band taking, you know, getting rolling and taking control of what it was, you really owned this music scene, especially on the heavier specter. You can go back again and listen to any episode of the Sound Atlas, and just about anybody brings up the band Sixth Floor, or will bring up a story about how their band opened for you,
mm-hmm.
How you guys used to travel and do shows together. You had a strong fan base and a lot of musicians here that would go see you guys and were inspired by you to start a band. So can you look back on at least the first, you know, the early days, the beginning days of what you all did? Do you see it now of the impact you had on the music scene?
Yeah, and I mean, I think a lot of people talk about Sixth Floor so much because it's a lot of it, I think, is this longevity. Because,
yeah.
You know, Jared told me a couple of years ago, he was just out of the blue. He said, man, I don't know what you do. He said, but you've always been able to stay relevant.
Yeah.
And I think it's just, I don't go away. I've always
been.
Well, but
I think a lot of people look at this band as they grew up with it. You know, you got to think a lot of people discovered you guys when they were just coming out of high school. So it's that moment of
yeah, and we went through as long as we've been together, we went through like two, almost three generations of fans. It's
exactly.
Like the people that came out in the early 90s, you know, people get older and they don't go out and
yeah.
get
married. Well, people refer to your songs as if they're talking about growing up and cruising around
mm-hmm.
listening to Zeppelin and Black Sabbath. They'll say Sixth Floor in that mix because they can.
Mm-hmm.
Your albums were a very big part of their youth, their life, and I think a lot of people lyrically related to what you were singing about. I mean, yeah. How many times do you hear people say, I went and saw them for the first time and they played Supergrass?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just go down this list of, you know, song titles that have held up to this day. But I mean, you know, in a local music format, looking back on it, look at what you all did. You know, you played at Gary's.
Mm-hmm.
You played at Thursdays, I think. Right?
Yeah. That's the first bar we ever played in.
Was it really?
We lived right down the road, and
that must have been an easy live there.
Yeah.
So when the band did get rolling, I mean, can you reflect back on anything that stood out to you, like, that kind of told you, this is it, this is what I need to do?
Just going through other bands before that and seeing, you know, and you've been through it, a lot of people like to talk about doing stuff.
Right.
But when it actually comes into putting in work,
right.
You know, it's a whole different story.
It is totally different.
Yeah. And
I like to tell the story of how most people I've met were procrastinators.
Mm-hmm.
They really wanted to be in a band,
yeah.
But they didn't like the word band practice
or work. Yeah.
I'm using quotations as I say these
things. Yeah.
But it's true. You understand that stuff, and obviously the guys you had did, and that's why you did what you did.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you were a pretty dominant factor of this music scene. Looking back on that, what stands out to you, though? I mean, the shows you played, the bands you got to work with.
we really worked hard. Like I said, I lived in Bowling Green, and two of the guys lived in, or me and Dave lived in Bowling Green, and the other two guys lived in Morgantown.
Right.
And Jared's dad had a farm out on the other side of Morgantown, and first time I drove over to practice, you know how far it is to my house.
I do.
It's like that far the other way. But it was a place to practice, you know. We've been practicing downtown and getting complaints and stuff, so we built a place to practice, really. But we would practice every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Damn.
for 5 or 6 years, even if we didn't have shows or anything. And back then I barely had money to pay rent, and I'm driving a Trans Am. It gets about 3 miles a gallon 3 days a week to Morgantown and back. But it was fun.
But you did it.
I've always enjoyed practicing just as much as playing.
To experience that with you, and I do miss a lot of that. In the early days, how long did it take before the band got started, before you made your first album?
We were together. We got together in February. I think we recorded it before. It was in the summer. We were together five or six months. Yeah.
Damn. And what was the first album?
It was just self-titled.
Self-titled.
Yeah.
You've put out a lot of records, though, over the years. I mean, not a lot, but many total you
We
think?
Put out five full-length, and then the Jägermeister four-song demo we done. And then we had four or five songs that we never released that we recorded, but they're going to be on the box set.
On the box set, which you've been working on as we are taping this.
Yep.
And I've been following that. It's pretty cool. A thumb drive.
Yeah. That's all Kenneth Maher's idea. He called me one day and he's like, man, let's do this. Cause I've been talking about it for years, and we got 70 something songs, and that's just trying to do all that with two CDs. It's just expensive and it's going to end up being so expensive. People don't want to buy it. But he came up with this thumb drive idea, and I was like, and that's genius. And I started reading about it, and a lot of people are doing that now.
It is. It really is. The way things seem to be going now.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, a true fan has the records, right?
Yeah. What I like about the thumb drive deal is, if there's a song that's not on here that somebody really wants or whatever, I can email it to them. They can take it and stick it on the thumb drive, and it's
true.
On there.
They can kind of make a mixtape of it.
Or if there's a song they don't like, they can take it off there.
That's true. Okay, so let's touch on the bass player thing real quick. You did have a lot of bass players. But that goes with just about any band.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that this band had such longevity, so to speak, how many bass players have you had? Or maybe not in number, but can you name them? Can you name them in the order they
were
in
the
band?
I did that on the way over here. So
there you go.
I don't know if I remember.
So Dave Shaver, right, was
the
first original bass player. And he was in the band for what?
About 5 years.
5 years. So around 2000, he left the band.
I think it was 99.
Who came in after him?
Rob Dale. He was from Russellville.
Yeah.
I don't know what bands he was in before that. But
I've heard that name.
He was a good bass player. And it was crazy because we'd met him and he was like a big fan of the band. And, and we went to practice the first time and he knew more of our stuff than we did. And
that's usually what a good fan does.
Yeah. And he could sing just like Gene Simmons. He was a cool dude. And
how long was he in the band?
I think he was in there 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
A couple of years at least.
That's better than 6 months.
Yeah.
I've dealt with those people. All right. So Rob was the second bass player. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good with names. Okay. Who was the third bass player?
Wade
England.
Yeah. And Wade, there's a
and
funny
Wade
story.
And Wade told his story.
Yeah.
In his
did he tell
podcast?
You about he told Rob he was going to take his job?
Yes.
Yeah, he did.
If you go back to Wade England's Sound Atlas, he tells the story about he came to see you guys in St. Louis. And I think he approached Rob after the show and said something about, if you ever screw up, I'm taking your job.
Yeah, he did.
And he said Rob giggled, and he was like, no, I'm serious. And he ended up taking his job because apparently Rob screwed up or something happened. But Wade England comes in, and Wade at that point was known as a guitar player, I guess.
But he was in gear. He played.
In gear.
He played guitar, and he played bass.
He ended up playing bass and gear, because he told all that, too, about how they were looking for a bass player to replace the one they had, but he was like, let me play bass. he wanted to play bass to like prove to himself that he could like do that. And so obviously he learned how to be a good bass player, and he ended up becoming Six Floors bass player. Mm-hmm. So Wade was in this for a while. He said some of the best moments of his music career happened when he was in the band.
It's fun. And, you know, Wade is a people person, and people love Wade to death. And
oh, yeah.
When it came to live show, I mean, that was when we were probably at our best live, just because me and Wade would, like, pick on each other on stage. Mm-hmm. And you could tell that it was a good camaraderie there. And, you know, I remember kicking him off top of the speakers, and he says he saved my life three times. I don't know about all that.
True.
Yeah.
So Wade was in the band for how long?
He was in there, I know he left the band about 2006, because that's when we opened for Disturbed and was getting ready to open for Skynyrd. I think he got in there about 2002 or 3.
Okay. And who came? Oh, wait. I think I know this. The fourth bass player should be Seth Sprouse.
No.
Just when I thought I had Six Floor.
Joe Parker.
Joe Parker.
Yep.
Okay. And when did Joe come in to the picture?
He came in right when we recorded Face Down, right after Wade quit.
Okay.
And then we
played. Did you ever have a time of being off for like 6 months because you were out of a bass player?
I don't think it was that long.
It never really had any like major downtime?
No. I mean, if I knew something was about to go wrong, I was always.
You were kind of ahead of the game on that. Yeah.
But Joe, he was, I don't know if he was in there a year or not. He recorded Face Down with us. He plays bass on Face Down. And he played with us when we opened for Skynyrd at Starwood.
Okay.
And then a few more shows. But
yeah, people still talk about that show to this day, which, you know, how can you not?
That's probably
a big deal.
We've done a lot of cool shows, but it's probably my favorite, just from the fact of being at so many shows at Starwood and watching all these bands, and then getting to actually be
on that stage.
Well, we played on the side stage, which is at the top of the hill.
Yeah, yeah.
They had a big, it was some magazine.
That's where I saw Tool on the second stage.
Yeah, when we were playing while they were opening the doors, started 10 minutes after they opened the gate.
Right.
I could sit there and see like a line of people. And, yeah. People came up, you know, and the whole, it was crowded.
Well, by that point, you all had a pretty established name, even outside of this particular music scene, or just the Bowling Green scene in general. You were getting out. You know, you had management, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had pretty good things going on. And that was also in the age of the internet starting to help with promotion and music and things of that nature. I'm assuming you had something in that realm, maybe not hands-on you personally, mm-hmm. but I'm sure you had people behind the scenes helping you in that way.
Yeah, Janet Johnson, which she's still a good friend of mine. She lives in Nashville now. And, she got us a lot of cool gigs and done a lot of good work for us.
Right.
And she was kind of like our mom, you know. She'd take care of it. It was like you would expect a manager to be, you know.
Right.
She would fuss at us when she needed to fuss at us, and she'd pat
good
us on the back when he did that.
Basically, yep, your parents.
Yeah.
So Joe Parker comes in after Wade England. Mm-hmm. He is the fourth bass player. That leads to
Seth
Sprouse.
Yeah,
was the fifth bass player. I interviewed Seth one of the early interviews I did. I don't recall if we captured that part of it or not, but that was a while back.
Yeah, I think he did. I listened to it, I think.
So Seth Sprouse comes in, and the interesting thing about Seth is he was in Seven Limbs.
Mm-hmm.
And Seven Limbs and Six Floor used to do a lot of shows together.
Yep.
And so he said, if I recall, that he was in both at the same time because Seven Limbs was kind of on and off, not really active, but they were still a band. They were still doing things, but maybe not on the scale of being busy.
Yeah, they were kind of slowing down, and he was also doing the New God at the time too, and started that. But yeah, Seth, one of the most talented people I've ever been with. He's, you know, we knew, and I think we tried to get him earlier, but you know, Seven Limbs was really doing a lot of stuff then. But you know, I knew him from, he was good friends with Nick, who I roommates with, and
right, yeah, he said he was around you guys in the early days.
We all hung out and partied together, and kind of pretty much the same scene. But you know, we all respected Seth because Seth is an excellent singer, songwriter, bass player, and play about anything.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's funny, I grew up with him, but yet I never witnessed a lot of things. I just knew him, mm-hmm. and my cousin Mike was good friends with him, and so I used to go see his bands or whatever he was doing. I got to witness just on the fact that I, my brother and my cousin knew him.
Yeah.
So that was always cool for me. But I was a big fan of Seven Limbs when they were around, and you guys played at, I would say, Gary's quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at Gary's. I lived close to Gary's,
yeah.
and I got to be good friends with Gary and his wife, mm-hmm. and it got to, there was a time there where they were kind of slow and wasn't getting any business, thought they were going to have to close, and I told him, I said, let me take care of some of the booking. I said, tell me how much you want to pay bands, and I'll get some bands.
Okay.
And there for a couple months that I'd done it, it was like, became one of the most happening places in Bowling Green for a while, because I would get bands that I wasn't necessarily into, but mm-hmm. I knew people like Catawampus and Radioactive Flowers, and you know, and then people,
you kind of understood
what the
scene was interested in. Seeing,
yeah, you got to get people that'll draw people. You know?
Yeah, it's a trick.
Yeah,
but you understand it. Seth Sprouse is Six Floors' fifth bass player.
Yeah,
how many more do we got?
We got old number six is what I call him now. Patrick O'Rourke is number six.
Now, wait a minute. Did John Fox play? Was that just temporary?
John Fox played guitar with us.
He did.
There was a little time frame.
When I knew there was a connection here.
Jared, I think it was right. I don't know what year it was. His daughter's about 10 now, I think. But when him and his wife first had the kid, he had to slow down. You know how that goes. And there were some shows he couldn't do. And John Fox knew everything. John Fox has always been a good friend, but he's like he's probably one of the biggest Six Floor fans.
Okay.
And he knew
all
song
the songs
backwards and forwards. And so it was just only natural to get him to do it.
Okay.
He played two or three shows with us. We played A1A and then we played Richmond, Kentucky. I'm not sure if he played anymore or not.
Well, it's hard to fit a lot of your history and a lot of things that you've done in the span of time we have to do this podcast. You've did a lot of cool things. One thing I'd like to touch on as a fan is the fact that you guys played at CBGB.
Mm-hmm.
Can you get into details of that? Do you recall much of it? Or
yeah.
Is there anything about that stood out? Were you on a tour?
No, we had a...
the East Coast or what?
That's when Scott Curtis was our first manager, which he was good friends with Dave. And he done some talking, and we got an entertainment lawyer in New York. And he was pretty big in the scene in New York. He wrote for Guitar Magazine and mm-hmm. stuff. But I think he'd worked with John Cougar or stuff like that. He'd done some stuff. And
so he had some connections. And
we got hooked up with him, and you know, he was trying to shop us. So we went to we got a showcase in New York.
Okay.
And so we drove up there in two different vehicles. I rode in the back of the back seat of an extended cab S10.
Wonderful.
For 1,000 miles.
About a 13-hour drive.
Yeah. And stayed at a Red Roof Inn. But we just pretty much showed up the day before, went and played the next day and went home. But we played for, it was Island Records, and I think Atlantic Records showed up. It was like on a Tuesday night and at 7 o'clock, you know.
You had a showcase for major labels at CBGB.
Yeah, on a Tuesday at 7 o'clock.
What year was this? Like,
it was 99.
Okay. It was later.
Yeah.
I was thinking it was like 96, 97. But
and
that's crazy.
But we show up, you know, we set up, and it's just, you know, it's a historic place. You go in there, and we've got pictures of us in the dressing room and all this stuff. There wasn't a lot of people there because, like I said, it was an off day.
Right.
But, you know, we played.
Well, it served purpose because this guy was trying to get you all signed.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, down here, a lot of us were hearing chatter about Six Floor might get signed. Like, I think everybody was on the verge of expecting something to come.
Back then, nobody besides the Headhunters had really, you know, rock bands had done.
Government Cheese did well. Black Cat Bone, Superfuzz. Like, there's a lot of things you can list, but did they break.
Yeah, it was Cage Elephant.
Did they win a Grammy?
Yeah.
Were they on national television? There were things of coolness that were happening of certain bands from not only Bowling Green or just the area,
mm-hmm.
but it seemed like you all were the ones that everybody was watching.
Well, I think a lot of it was we'd been around for quite a while.
At that point, yeah.
Played anywhere and everywhere we could, and we were just people that knew us knew we were just regular guys.
You had a grassroots built fan base.
Yeah.
And that's really what it boils down to, is you had a fan base of loyal fans that were helping get the name out, helping introduce people
mm-hmm.
across the country to you guys that may not live here, and obviously that played a role. But you did have the right connections. But like you always tell me, almost.
Yeah.
It's like,
I mean,
it was right there.
Well, the thing was, we played for, I think it was Island. No, it was Interscope. We played, they were there.
See, I would have thought that would have been a good label for your all's music to be on.
Interscope was there. That guy wasn't really impressed with us. And I know, like, we played, we were nervous.
Yeah.
And guitar was out of tune half the time. Mm. And I look back at the pictures, and I'm like, we had absolutely no kind of image, which we were anti-image anyway. But, you know, when you're trying to get somebody to be able to
if you only
sell
knew
your music,
then
yeah,
what you know now kind of thing.
You'd brush your hair and stuff, but, you know. But Interscope didn't really dig us. And then Atlantic, I think they just showed up. We weren't even expecting them to show up. Hmm. And Scott knew the guy, the A&R guy, or knew who he was when I saw him. And went up to hand him a CD and dropped it on the sidewalk, and it like shattered on the sidewalk. But we left and thought, well, that was that chance, you know.
Yeah.
And then,
but the whole way home, you're like, we just played CBG.
Well, the next day, we got, it might have been that night or the next day, Island Records called us and was like, the guy, A&R guy, was like, man, I've heard your demo, just heard it. Like to talk to you guys and all this. He wasn't even at the showcase.
Hmm.
And we was like, well, you know, we'll come back and showcase again when we need to or whatever. And he said, no, I'll come to Bowling Green and see you guys.
Interesting.
And he pretty much told us that he was impressed so much he wanted to sign us. And we talked back and forth to him for 2 or 3 weeks. And we set up at Kelly Green, set up a Tuesday night. That's when he wanted to see us, was a mm-hmm. Tuesday night. A showcase deal.
What is it about these Tuesday night showcases?
I don't know. I guess they want to see if you can really draw a crowd. But that night, there was a big merger going on in the record company. They said it was a Seagram's merger. They bought, a bunch of them bought out other ones and stuff.
Weird.
But he was going to come and see us that night, and it snowed like 6 inches.
And, of course.
And I think we were on the way to the gig or whatever. Scott, our manager, got a call, and the dude said he just got fired.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we have to go play this big show, which about 200 people show up on a Tuesday with snow on the ground. We had to play this show knowing the whole time that we're not going to get signed. And, you know, people are bringing people to see us and patting us on the back, and we're all just like about to jump off a bridge.
The word had gotten out that they really thought this was happening.
Yeah. But that was the first time.
Golly, dude. Well, again, it's hard to put it all in this episode. What else stands out to you in not really the early days, but just the major part of it? Because at this point, can you say safely that Sixth Floor, the name, the band, lasted up until about 2010?
Mm-hmm.
Is that about right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, since we've got back together, a lot of people, when we done the first show and sold it out in 2 days, a lot of people thought it was just a reunion. And I kept telling people, it's not, you know, we're going to keep doing stuff.
We're not going to do what we were doing, but we're going to at least stay together and play when we feel the need or when it's a good show offer, all that stuff.
We're pretty much.
But not every weekend.
Yeah.
Not traveling, not touring, any of that.
Yeah, and that's one thing we done early back in when we started was played too much. I mean, it helped us, but as far as we'd play Kelly Green's one night, next night play Gary's, and you know, and if you play too much, if you're young and in a band, if you play too much in the same town,
yeah,
people will know.
It'd be different if you were like crisscrossing the state and doing different venues.
Yeah, when we started really getting the following was when we started going to Lexington and Richmond. And when you do that...
Well, again, go back to the original formation of the band between, let's say, 95 to 2000, what? Let's say the first decade, 95 to 2005. Pretty active, really active. You put a lot of records out. You traveled a lot. You played a lot of shows.
Mm-hmm.
You did some cool things, like you said, with the Starwood thing, you opening for Skinner on the Pavilion at Starwood.
Mm-hmm.
But you also got to open for like some major acts.
Disturbed.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got sponsored by Jägermeister. And
yeah, and that's where the four song thing came out.
Yeah.
That's a cool, I have that.
The guy from Jägermeister called me one day, and I was at home, just got off work from pouring concrete, and he was like, he just said, "Hey, is this John?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You want to open for Disturbed next month?" You know, I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Don't you need to talk to anybody?" I was like, "No, they're going to do it." You know, but
they'll do it.
Played Toy Tiger back in the day.
I was going to say, we got to hit on some of the clubs you hit that are no longer around.
We played with Rat at the Toy Tiger.
See? That's crazy.
And I was like a huge, growing up, a huge Warren DeMartini fan. Yeah. Got to stand there like...
Is this the Rat that didn't have Steven?
No, this was the original.
It was?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. Come on, man. Give us some more stuff. We got plenty of them.
I don't know. I mean, we didn't do a whole lot of national openers. We played with Hell Yeah when that Alcohol and Ass song came out. Everybody thought that was us. When that song came on the radio...
They thought it was you?
They swore up and down it was us. And it does kind of sound like me if you listen it. But everybody thought it was us.
That's wild.
Oh, I tell you about the Metallica deal. When we first come out with that first CD, we sent it to, I think it's the radio station in Louisville. There's two big ones there. Well, we sent it to one. The guy's name was, I think his radio name is Black Frank. We sent him a CD of the first one, and he sent it to to Fox or whatever. Mm-hmm. He sent it to them, and he took it and put it in a different package. And it's right when Metallica's, it was a Black album just came out or something. But he sent it to the other radio station.
In 91?
No, maybe.
Was 95 or the early days, it was for you, mid-90s. Would have been Load or Reload.
It might have been Load. But he sent it to them packaged as like a radio copy of the new Metallica, and it was us. So they got on the radio for 3 days and said, Friday at 10, we're going to play the new Metallica, and it was us they played.
Wow.
And they got mad and called Jared. Somehow they got Jared's phone number. Called him, cussing him, and he didn't even know what was going on. And come to find out, it was the other radio station that played a trick on him. But
wow. How ridiculous is that?
Yeah.
That's weird. Man, I don't even know where to go. There's so many questions I guess you could ask, but you've also answered the same ones over and over for years, you know. As far as the history of the band goes, I do know one cool thing on a local level, since this is based on Bowling Green local music scene. Tommy Starr said he was at Revolution, which at the time would have been New Rock, maybe, still.
Yeah.
It should still have been New Rock 92. But before it was Revolution 91.7, it was New Rock 92, and he was a DJ there. And you guys came up to do an interview before a show. Would have been at what at that point? Probably Gary's? Did you ever play at night class or any campus activity stuff?
I don't know if we did. No, we played.
It may have been a Thursdays or a Gary's.
It was probably Thursdays.
But he said that somebody called him and said, "Hey, would you be interested in interviewing this band? They're playing a show."
Yeah.
And he was like, "Yeah, sure." And he said it was the first time he had done, I don't know if it was an interview of a band or just an interview of a local band.
It was an interview of us, I think. I think before that, wasn't he in Memphis or something?
Yeah, but I know there's a, and I hate that if I'm getting this wrong, but it was either the first time he had ever interviewed a band in general or just you guys.
It
was the first time you all were on the radio.
He was the first person to ever interview us. Yeah.
Okay. And so that was your first time on the radio station or on a radio to promote a show.
Yeah.
And that would have been obviously 95, 96, right?
Yeah. We've been around so long, we were on KDF once.
That's pretty cool. Before it was country?
Yeah. when it was pure freaking rock.
Pure rock and roll. But Tommy likes to tell that story because that's something to be proud of. You know, he was the first DJ to interview 6ix4.
Yep.
And put your song on the radio and promote your show.
Yep, Tommy.
And then, well, yeah, he played a pretty... I think that may have kicked the gears in for him on a local music scene, too. And again, Tommy, I'm sorry if I'm getting all this wrong. But I've heard him tell these stories enough to kind of catch up or catch on to what he was meaning at, you know. And look at what he's done for all of us now.
Oh, yeah.
You know? But that may have been the Kickstarter, in a way, for him to get to that point.
It helped us out a lot, too. You know, back in the day, it was kind of hard to be local and get on the radio. Right. And
I think, again, you look back on that moment where guys like him and the amplifier was brand new, and a lot of that stuff started happening around that early, mid-90s. Yeah. And I think you guys forming and getting out and started doing your thing happened at the right time, if you were looking at it from the local standpoint. Bratcher got involved with you pretty early on, too, I believe.
I met, Wade knew Bratcher from Glasgow. I didn't, and I can't remember what it was.
Right, because he was from the Louisville area, and he told, again, in his podcast, that he had moved down here like three times before he settled, and Wade was like the first person he met and got into local music stuff. And
yeah, I remember.
So he met you around probably 2000 then.
It was after that. It was probably 2003 or 2004, I think.
But if you look at, I mean, we could probably list a bunch of people, but you cannot do this and talk about your band's history without talking about Tommy Starr and Bratcher playing a significant role of supporter on radio.
Yeah.
Getting your all's name out, playing your songs, promoting your shows, especially in that heyday period of those years.
Yeah.
Of how busy you all were. They were a big part of that.
A lot of that was when there was no MySpace or no anything.
There was nothing.
You know, and if you wanted to get people at a show, you had to go stick a flyer on a telephone pole, you know. But it's unbelievable how many options bands have nowadays.
Yeah.
And looking at it now, I don't even think you need a record contract nowadays. I mean, you can make.
I don't think you do.
I think
my philosophy now is if you're traveling. And you're able to eat and survive, and you're a musician.
Yeah,
then you're doing something.
I think you need a good booking agency, but I don't think
that
you need
usually
a record
helps.
Label. Yeah,
but even now with internet stuff, you can kind of hide behind a third identity. And be like John Doe, but yet you're John Doe.
Yeah,
booking yourself. But in the early days, or at least the first decade, obviously those two guys played a big role in helping you guys.
Yep. Tommy was really helped us in the earlier days. He played, you know, and he still plays a lot when he can. He really loves the early stuff. You know how Tommy is. He likes the raw, produced.
The power of it.
Yeah. And then Bratcher came along about right before we'd done Face Down, and then Bratcher put us in regular rotation on the point. And I mean, it just went through the roof. Then after that, you know, that's when that was our biggest, highest point.
Right.
And, I mean, it got to the point where I'd go anywhere in town and, you know, people were coming up talking to me and stuff. But that song, and I'd turn on the radio at work, and they'd play it, you know, three times before lunch, you know. But that really pushed us over the edge. And Bratcher was really in there. He worked with our manager a lot as far as, you know, helping us do stuff and trying to point us in the right direction.
Right.
And, you know. He's really was instrumental in a lot of that stuff.
They were, and they both deserve a round of applause for what they did, not only for you guys, but for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, we all need to show appreciation to Tommy and Bratcher. But, again, there's other DJs in this scene that have done a lot of great things. But these two guys really took local serious. They made a point to be like, this needs to be heard. This needs to be shared. And I think the reason this music scene has been the success that it is because of them.
Yeah, and there was a time, it was a short period of time, but I don't know if you were ever involved with it, Tony Rose and Drew Schroeder.
Yep.
Done that local, I don't know what.
It was on the Gator.
Yeah. And they started that, and they had like award shows for local bands and stuff. I've got one in my basement.
Yeah. Best live performance. Rhonda helped. Rockin' Rhonda helped people. Kelly McKay helped local music get on the radio. And Tony has helped bands over the years. Brian Locke. I mean, I could go down this, again, this list of people.
We have a guy.
You can't deny those two. Yeah. You just can't.
Louie. I don't know how you pronounce his last name, but
Louie the local guy.
Yeah, man, he.
I don't know his last name. I just know Louie the local.
I don't know how you pronounce it, but he helped us a lot in Louisville.
Yeah, he's still a big important part of the local Louisville music scene.
He's a good dude.
He was down here not that long ago.
He was at the Tammy
at
show.
At Tammy Wilson's show. When was that? January or February? It was back in February, I think. You're not good with this.
No, you are.
I'm the date guy. Well, we got to get to these other things because they are worthy of mentioning. Sixth Floor lasted solid for a long time. Mm-hmm. At some point, you went off and did not only Southbound and Sinners, or not Sinners and Saints. I knew I was going to do that. Sons of the Revolution and Southbound, but you also made a solo record.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when what happened there? Did you said Jared had his daughter, right?
Yeah, it got to the point where we'd been doing it for
10, 15 years.
Before that, we were talking to Clutch's label, DRT, at the time.
Okay.
And they pretty much told us we were about to get a record deal, and we used to try to get on tour with Clutch and stuff a lot, but... I remember I was in Owensboro, I think it was 2008 or 9, and Bratcher and my manager called me on a three-way call, and I was standing in a liquor store in Owensboro, and they said, I hope you're sitting down because DRT is about to offer us a record deal. And I said, okay. And they said, you're not excited? I said, no. I said, when I see it. Check in the mail, I'll get excited.
You've been through that already.
But right? thought it was a done deal, and I don't think they went out of business or something.
You're kidding. What in the world? Was it a Tuesday night?
Nah, it probably was. But, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to say it was a Tuesday night.
I'm not bitter.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people were not only in your... They were rooting in your corner for you to see something come of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can all agree at this point that you earned it. And it's kind of sad that it didn't happen. It's on the scale, you know, of being MTV tour buses, or at least making it to the level of success. Success being you all don't have day jobs anymore.
And it was crazy.
Building roofs could have been a hobby for you.
It's crazy the people that used to come up to me and be like, I'd say something about work, and they're like, you work? And I was like, yeah, well, I got to eat.
You know, well, before you advertised heavily, I don't think people actually may have thought you were touring band, you know.
But that's one thing.
They live in a bubble.
A lot of musicians kind of get to the point when they're young, they're like, oh, I can't work and really put focus on music. That's a bunch of crap.
I kept a job. You make time for it. That's my rule.
We all had jobs through the whole time, you know, and because, you know, I didn't have anybody giving me money and buying my equipment, so I had to.
You literally earned everything. You built everything that you have.
Yeah.
I know that. Not figuratively, you know, but, you know, you earned your life. The life you have today, you earned it. But anyway, so that didn't happen. That last hoorah, a potential record label, right? What happened to the branching off? What did you do first?
Then Southbound first.
So Southbound came about first thing.
Yeah.
But it still consisted of members of Sixth Floor.
George was in there. He was the only one.
Okay.
At that time. Jared, that's right. Jared ended up jamming with us later on.
That's what I thought, because I've seen pictures, but... Southbound comes together, and it was you and Frankie Froge and George Collard. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
I always know if I say his name right or wrong. And Wade England was in that band.
For a little while.
Yeah.
Who was
the bass player?
Andy Piper was the first bass player.
Okay.
And then Paul Hatchett played with us for a while.
Okay. So what was the point of Southbound forming?
It was just...
Did you end the name at that point, or was it just like a side project for you?
It's pretty much a side project, but it got to the point where I felt like we weren't doing as much as we should be doing, mm-hmm. you know, and it, you know, people were having kids and we just, you know, got messed up on our second record deal. Right. So it, I guess morale was low at the time, but I just, you know, I couldn't stand not playing. And I was right. like, well, and I've always loved like Black Crowes type music, Southern rock, right. Allman Brothers. And I'd always wanted to do something like that anyway. And me and Frankie had talked, and we played with Southern Thunder all the time. So,
oh, that's right.
It was, you know, we talked about doing something.
I think he mentioned that in his episode, too.
But, you know, it was just, at the time, I didn't feel like 6-4 was playing as much as we should. So, okay. I just had to do something to stay busy.
Well, you formed that. How long was Southbound around?
Probably.
I mean, technically, it was an active working band.
3 or 4 years, I guess.
Yeah. And you had through, different members?
Yeah, we went through different members.
And you played, obviously, I've seen video of you guys playing at Tidballs. You played Miss Kitty's a lot, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
on
for
a local
while.
Level. Yep. Did you play a lot of other stuff around here or just random?
Southbound.
Yeah.
We played Cadillac Ranch and on Broadway in Nashville once.
Oh, that's cool.
Fat Jam and stuff like that. We didn't branch out a whole lot.
Mm, okay. But you did have a different people in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who else was in the band besides who we mentioned?
George played. After a while, George ended up quitting. And then we got Reed Wilkinson, which was in Undead Anna.
Right.
Played with us for a while.
And I think that's what Wade said, that the two of them clicked really good in Southbound and formed Undead Anna.
Yep. Yeah, he stole
it. It all connects, people.
Yeah. Delbert Fields played with us for a little while.
That's interesting.
Delbert is... We was talking, me and Jerry both look up to Delbert. You know,
Delbert's phenomenal.
He is. He can play anything.
And he's one of those guys, too, that can play a guitar upside down and, like,
yeah, and
really
play
well.
It, play it through a Craco speaker and make it sound like something.
But that band lasted for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you branched off and made a solo record. Was that in between?
It was after. Well, I'd made a solo record 2 years ago.
Well, the first one, though, you made like one CD.
Oh, yeah.
Was that in between Southbound and Sons of the Revolution? Or?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Just somewhere in there you did something on
your
own.
Yeah, I didn't hardly.
You tested the waters of like playing acoustic guitar and stuff.
I didn't, yeah, and I think I made 100 copies of it and never made another. Okay. I just wanted them.
But it's out there.
Yeah.
And you did it. Sons of the Revolution comes about, and that again started as something new, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it did end up becoming kind of like 6-4 because George and Jared were in that too. Mm-hmm. But I interviewed Jason and he talked about a little bit about that. He had heard 6-4 and I think Southbound,
mm-hmm.
and was like, I need to meet this guy. I want to play music with him. And he did. He knew Mike, and that's how all of mm-hmm. you all got together. So if I recall correctly, Sons of the Revolution was you on guitar and vocal, Jared on guitar, George on drums, Jason Simpson on bass, and mm-hmm. Mike Bull on guitar.
Yep.
And he thinks that when he first played a show, the venue billed it as 6-4.
Yeah.
But you said you can do whatever, but yeah. we're coming as Sons of the Revolution.
Yeah.
Well, Sons of the Revolution started with you making a record
mm-hmm.
and putting that name on it, correct?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
you used your own stuff in your own studio.
Mm-hmm.
You played all the instruments and everything, right?
On some of them I did. Some of them.
The first
record. I had a few, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 songs that were done, and then they recorded on some of the other ones.
That's right.
Yeah, it kind of started out, Mike was working for me, and he just got off the road with Blackstone Cherry
right.
doing tech work and didn't really want to do that anymore, was looking for a job, so I hired him, and he worked with me, and we talked about playing music and stuff mm-hmm. and really wanted to try to do something, and then Jared and George started getting to where they were wanting to kind of play again. And so
and it just kind of fell together.
Yeah.
That lasted a decent while, right?
Yeah.
About maybe 2 or 3 years, if that.
A couple years.
You made 2 records. The first one was pretty much you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one, they were on.
Yeah.
And you recorded it at your home studio, which is Workhorse.
Yeah.
Is that the studio or the record label that you have?
I just use both. It for everything.
Because that's what you are.
Yeah.
You're a workhorse.
Yeah.
So that went on for a bit, and then it came to an end, and I entered the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when John King and the Mud River Revival came into play.
Yep.
And that is still going on. So we are at modern day time.
Mm-hmm.
So during this time, there was a brief period where you do all these different projects, and then I come into the picture because we had talked out of the blue about doing something.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like you wanted to start another side project, but more of a recording thing.
Yeah.
And then lo and behold, it became a band. Next thing I know, we're playing gigs and we have a name and making a record.
I just wanted to do something different, you know.
Right. Six Floor is very heavy, very intense band. John King and the Mud River Revival coming out of Southbound and Sons of the Revolution. Very Southern rock influenced, country fills are in there. You really got to experiment with other sides of your songwriting ability.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point of all of these things, is that you wanted to experiment.
Six Floor is kind of like a one-trick pony when it comes musically, but it does that one trick very well. But, you know, it's I wanted to do something that was more, had more dynamics in it, and just throw in a bunch of different instruments, fiddle, mandolin,
right,
make something that was kind of earthy sounding. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan of like John Prine and stuff like that, and singer-songwriter stuff.
Right.
And I, you know, even when Six Floor was really going back in the early days, I listened to a lot of stuff like Charlie Daniels.
Right.
I mean, I didn't listen to a lot of stuff that people would expect me to listen to.
Well, I mean, that might be a lot of your upbringing, though, because you were raised in that environment.
And it's one magazine that reviewed something we done. They were like, Six Floor is like a Corrosion of Conformity with a country singer, you know, because, you know, I didn't.
That's a pretty good way to put it.
And I love Corrosion.
Oh, man, that's funny. But you've done all these other things, and I'm thankful I got to be a part of that. I was the first drummer for the band, but Mud River Revival is still a band.
Mm-hmm.
Although Mike and Jason and I are no longer in the band, who is in the band today?
Carrington Hart plays drums. I met him too. I played at the Butler County has an Opry every year.
Yeah. The and Butler County Opry.
He was a drummer with Rose Band because their drummer couldn't do it or something. Mm-hmm. But I saw him and I was like, well, I'm going to steal him. Cause
the Rose Family Band's got stories to tell of their own.
Yeah.
We should have a podcast on that.
Yeah. And then Patrick, which plays bass, and Six Floor plays
right,
bass.
Right. He is the current and latest bass player.
Yeah, he's playing bass in two bands and hasn't got fired. And Joe Whittinghill was our fiddle player, which I met him. He came up to record on my solo thing I done last year, Hard Lessons Learned.
Right.
And people told me about him, and I didn't know much about him, but he came over and played and killed it. And I was like, you want to play in, you know, some shows? And I figured he'd say no. He's like, yeah, man, whatever. And I got to looking up on YouTube, and he's won 7 state championships.
Yeah,
he's
pretty awesome.
And he's known around the bluegrass community quite well.
Well, you definitely have a good lineup now, but
it's different. You know, it's
different than what it was when it first started. But you had 3 guys that come from that rock background, you know. And
I still that Right the Wrong that album. You know,
it
I tell
holds.
People it was like lightning in a bottle, like
it
Jason
was,
said.
And I'm really proud of that. But speaking of that record, and all every band you've been in. You've made sure to record. You've released several Six Floor albums. You've also released albums under Southbound and Sons of the Revolution. I believe has 2, right? Southbound has 1 CD. Sons of the Revolution had 2, an album and an EP, The Mean Machine, right? And you've done the solo record, which you said was only kind of more personal.
Yeah.
But you did do something.
Mm-hmm.
But then Mud River has 2 records, right? The first one's Right the Wrongs, and the latest one is...
Well, it's pretty much a solo one. It's
what we played.
Yeah, it was kind of the downtime of Mud River when, you know, when that kind of went south for a while.
Yeah.
So
you took a collection of recordings that you had, plus stuff you did on your own?
Yeah. 4 of the I think it was four of the songs on there were songs that Mud River, After You, went to record at Barracks.
That's
and
right.
And then I put them on there, and I just added some more stuff
okay.
on it.
Okay, well, yeah, again, but it's still kind of, it connects the two worlds,
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
So you've been really good about capturing and recording. I think a lot of bands I've talked to, I've kind of been amazed at how many people were active musically, but never recorded a record or released it. A lot of people record stuff and never do anything with
yeah.
it. That's always fascinated me. You always made a point to put out releases.
Yeah.
And that's something
I love recording, man. It's, yeah. I love it.
But you're proud of your work, you know, your songwriting, the sounds, the people you worked with, you're proud of it. So
yep.
you wanted it to be done. Speaking of the recording thing, what I'm getting to with all of this is that you've always worked with David Barrett.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been from the beginning with Sixth Floor?
Yeah. I didn't know him when I was in Glasgow, but after I got in the music scene, I started hearing about him all the time.
Right.
And he was above Backstage Music then.
Okay.
And I told them, you know, we were practicing in Morgantown. I said, we need to record because I recorded in Kansas at a place called City Spark, but it was like $1 million studio.
Yeah.
The drum room was like wood shaped like yeah. a hexagon or
Elegant.
Something. It was a floating floor, and
yeah.
but it sounded like crap.
Yeah.
But I knew as soon as we started playing, I was like, we got to record. That's the first step of actually trying to
yeah.
show people that you're serious.
You have to have something to put out there.
And, so I talked to Barrick and we went in there and it was fun. I still remember that like it was yesterday, you know. He was like, that's the first time I ever put a toilet flushing on a CD. And I played, in Kentucky Love Song, I actually played Greg Martin's guitar. It was a dub.
That's funny. I'm glad you mentioned that song because a lot of people to this day pester you really hard for you to play.
I haven't played that song in probably 20 years, and I mean I didn't play it the last 10 years of Sixth Floor really doing something. I didn't
yeah.
play it, and it's not,
it's
because
a novelty thing, you know?
It's not, and it's not on the box set, but I've told people if they order the box set and they've got
to
have it, I'll email it to them. But and it's not,
that's dangerous.
Well, it's not necessarily the cussing, because there's songs on there that's got cussing.
Well,
on
of course, but
it's mean spirited, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And
well, again, you know, you're young.
Yeah.
You were just doing your thing.
You don't care about people's feelings when you're that age.
You do now.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't argue with your past or what you've done, you know.
No, just got to learn from it.
But you, you've always been really good about recording and putting out records. And again, you've seemed to have a really good relationship with David Barrett.
Mm-hmm.
You've recorded, I'm assuming, in all of the studios he's...
like, except the new one.
You haven't been to the new one yet?
No, and he's been on me about it. He sent me a message not too long ago, and I've told him, you know, and I've got to the point where my studio, I feel comfortable doing everything there but drums, because,
right.
you know, he gets a great drum sound. And
yeah,
never,
he's phenomenal. But he knows how to mic them. And
I've told him not too long ago, I was like, I would like to... Sixth Floor's wanting to record a few songs. I would like to come down there and lay down the drums and the bass, and then take it home and do the rest of it, because I've got the same Pro Tools and stuff and
right.
mastering he's got, but I just don't have the other equipment he's got.
Yep.
And what I like about doing it at home, it's not that I don't trust him with it, because he's done everything we've done.
Well, it's a convenience thing.
It's a money thing, and then it's convenience, because at home, you know, if I'm having a... when you go to the studio, you've got this amount of time to do this.
Right.
If your allergies are bothering, your voice ain't good, tough, you know,
you have to cancel. And,
but
yeah.
at home, you know, if I go up there and it ain't feeling it, I can go home, come back next
yep,
day, you know.
Exactly.
And I will spend, when it comes to recording and mixing and stuff, I will sit there just like a mad scientist, you know, for hours, because I love it that much.
Yep. But you are currently, as we speak, Sixth Floor did get back together. This was about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you have been playing, not obviously what you did years and years mm-hmm. ago, but you all are back together.
Yep.
And it's solid with Patrick on bass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going really good. You've had some really successful shows since the rebirth of it, so
yep.
to speak. Obviously, the name holds up. It means a lot to a lot of people. The songs mean a lot to a lot of people. The joke I got to make recently made my day. Because Tammy Wilson, and I've mentioned this in other episodes, Tammy Wilson had a benefit show back in January, February 2019. And you all played, along with a slew of other bands that were there, all in support to raise money for her going through all of this crap that she's going through. And before I introduced you guys on stage, I'm sitting there and I'm like, I've seen this band twice, 1995 and 2019. And it's true. I never saw you in those other times before. Tommy Starr, what are you doing? Oh, Tommy Starr's not here. I'm dreaming.
Yeah.
But I thought that was funny because I never saw you guys in those times, because I was in bands, you were in bands, and our bands didn't work together. But that's a true story.
You just beat us and quit coming and see us again.
I saw you twice. I've seen 6'4" twice with the original bass player and the current bass player.
Yep.
But you guys did get back together in, was that 2018 or 2017?
I think 2018.
It was 2018. And you've done a handful of shows since then. And how's it going? Is it like riding a bike?
It's going good. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of it is our crowd's getting older. And, you know, when we first started playing out, we sold out the first two shows. And then we played a show, you know, it was a decent crowd, but it wasn't what I expected, especially in Glasgow. It was at Ribblickers. It was Halloween weekend. There was a million things going on.
Come on, that's Halloween.
But, you know, there's times when I've been like, well, people just don't care about it no more. But
you know more than anybody. It's a
lot of it. Like I said, our crowd is older. They don't go out. You know, back in the day, I was always at Tidballs or somewhere hanging out, networking, and, you know, people come out. But a lot of our crowd is 40-something years old or older, and they don't get out and run around like
they
used to.
Now they have kids.
Yeah,
you know,
or grandkids.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know,
that's where we are.
That's a lot of it, I think.
But the important thing is that you guys are still doing it. And it really goes to show, if you look at the people younger than us now, the guys that are in their 20s, actually grew up hearing you guys. You know, it's like I've interviewed the guys in Kiss Kiss Bang, and they all mentioned you guys and the impact it had on them.
Yep.
So how's it feel to be influential on this next generation coming up?
It feels good, as long as they've got good influence, I guess, from it.
Well, I mean,
there's a lot of bad influence.
What they've all seemed to have come to take from it is the music, the honesty of it, and the hard work aspect of it.
Yeah.
They all have picked up on that, you know.
I'm friends with the guys in Kiss Kiss Bang, and I talked to him quite a bit, and Crowder, I've worked with him. He's recorded at the house.
Yeah, he's been recording at your place.
And I, you know, when I heard him and saw what they were doing, and I was like, you know, this, it was almost like passing the torch to them as far as, because, you know, to me, it's real. It's not made up, and I think they really got a good thing going on. It's just, it's hard for me, been there, done that at my age, to hang around and talk to him much without trying to be like, you need to do this, you need to do that.
Right.
You know, I just watch from a distance.
You know, some of the guys will listen to us older dudes and take it, you know, like, because they don't want to make mistakes. But then again, we're talking about stuff in the 90s that doesn't even really matter at this point.
Yeah.
You know? Record labels.
I was at a store, me and my wife were at a store the day buying a mattress, and this girl, she looked fairly young. She said, I know you from somewhere, and was looking at me, and I was like, either she thinks I'm Kid Rock or
you've
got to
get tired of that.
And she said, yeah. And she said, she said, I got it. I remember it now. She said, y'all played it at our middle school when I was in fifth grade. And I was like, and how old are you now? And she was like 30-something. But I guess we played it. I was like, when the hell did we play at a middle school? But it was Wade's wife, Marla, taught at middle school. And one day we rolled in there and played scared the hell out of a bunch of little kids.
That's funny. See all the good memories you have. Well, as far as local music scene goes and your involvement in it, you've done a lot of great things. You've got to work with a lot of cool bands, a lot of good venues. Unfortunately, a lot of them are gone when you refer back to the old days. As far as now going, juggling 6'4" and Mud River Revival, who are you a fan of out there today? Like, what bands are you hooking up with and working with and... Anybody come to mind? Or
like local bands?
Yeah.
I really like Kiss Kiss Bang, Wolf Island Cosmonauts. Mm-hmm. I like those dudes. And I don't, you know, usually when we play now, we're either having an acoustic opener or something. Cause,
right. Yeah, Frankie recently opened.
Yeah, Frankie's doing some good stuff, and I'm glad he finally has, because he's talked about it for years, but I'm glad he finally done it. But I don't get into the scene as much as I used to. It's just raising a kid and
running a business. Well, you own the business. I mean, you own it and you run it.
Yeah.
So obviously that can't be unsaid.
But I like a lot of what I'm hearing. It's, you know, a lot of people say, oh, the scene ain't what it used to be. I don't know, because I'm not in it, you know.
I hear that sometimes, and then, I don't know, I've seen some stuff that I've kind of walked away from, gritting my teeth. But every now and then, I'll see something from the younger kids. You know, I can call them kids because I'm old. But people in their 20s that are playing out now, I can go home and be like, man, the scene's in good shape. Like, we're okay. Like, I'm glad that I've got to be a part of it. And I know you are too. Whether or not you had an influence on them or not, it is a connection as far as this music scene goes. We all may not know each other, but we are connected. And we've all played a role in the direction it's gone.
Yep.
I think the success that a lot of it's had and the impact it's had on the next generation of musicians coming up. You've played a big role in that.
Before us, there was, you know, Government Cheese, and I was always a big fan of Daddy Long Leg, and they were kind of winding down when we started, but, you know.
Yeah, we used to open for Daddy Long Leg.
30-35, and, you know, there's a bunch of them. I remember seeing 30-35 at Summerfest in Glasgow when I was like 17 in a big stage, but, I always respected the dudes that came, you know, that came before me and listened to them, and Eddie Vinson, Mike Thompson, all those guys, and, you know.
It was a good time. But, yeah, you and I are kind of part of that late 80s, early 90s generation. Like, just as our bands started to take off, we were getting out, and we were old enough to go see those bands play. Mm-hmm. So that's a cool thing to have. I hope those guys realize the impact they had on us, even though their bands may have not lasted long or had any major success or released anything. It meant a lot to us.
I saw, every time I see Eddie Vinson, I sat down. He was at a bar one day talking to a bunch of people, and I sat down and said, oh, I get to sit next to a legend. I always aggravate him. He's like, he don't want to hear it. He's like, yeah, whatever.
Well, you've definitely made an impact on the music scene and a lot of the musicians, not only your own age, but younger generation. And you've done a lot of cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back on all of it, even though you're still active today, it's not like you're, you know, done.
Yeah.
But looking back on it, what stands out to you?
I've never considered myself a good singer. I've always been proud of my songwriting, but I think what I'm most proud of is connection with the people that come and see us, you know. And I think that's why a lot of people followed us for a long time, is just because I always try to connect with the people. A lot of times I'd be somewhere and somebody'd ask me for an autograph, and I'd ask them for theirs. You know, my wife's like, you act like it embarrasses you. And I was like, I just don't feel like I should be giving anybody an autograph. But,
well, I get that.
Yeah, I mean,
I can see that. Well, John, you've been a part of the scene for a long time. You've helped shape it, and you're still doing it. So, on behalf of the music scene, I can say that a lot of other people would say thank you for what you've done and for being an inspiration to so many out there. And as a fan, I can say thank you, but also as a former bandmate, I can say thank you. I was really happy that we got to work together. That meant a lot to me.
Like I said, I'm really proud of that album, and when Man on the Mountain, all that stuff come out, I mean, I'm not saying I was hoping for a record deal or anything, but I had a feeling. Well, I mean, there for a minute, I had a feeling something might happen.
I thought something could have happened, but yeah, it didn't.
And I realized I was old as hell. And
it must have been a Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Well, John, I don't know what else to say at this point. I think we've covered your life, your career, your musical journey. So thank you for your time tonight, and you are on your way to play Tidballs. Live on the Lot at Tidballs.
And this makes me feel old. 14 years ago, we played our 10-year anniversary at Tidballs.
And that says it all.
Yeah.
Well, John, thanks again for your time, and keep doing what you do.
You too, man. You do a good job at this.
Yay!